Hi, my name is Doug Phillips from Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. I'm the podcast editor for the American Journal of Neuroradiology. It's my pleasure to bring you the January choices. Let's begin with the Fellows Journal Club choices. The first article by Fabiars and Newsom, entitled Quality Control in Neuroradiology, Discrepancies in Image Interpretation Among Academic Neuroradiologists. This paper was first published online October 27, 2011. This article should interest our fellows since most of them train at academic institutions. These authors looked at 1,000 neuroimaging studies that were subsequently re-reviewed as the data acquisition phase of a potential PQI project. Each examination was selected because it had follow-up studies and were read as a secondary interpretation during the early morning by a staff neuroradiologist reading on that particular day, and discrepancies were noted and scored. The scoring system was a previously validated system for re-reviews. The five-point scale allows the following categories. Choice 1, no change in the reading. Choice 2, finding of a clinically insignificant detection discrepancy, for example, a missed case of chronic sinusitis. Choice 3, a finding of clinically insignificant interpretation discrepancy. The example here, the interpretation of an oligodendroglioma as an astrocytoma. Choice 4, a finding of a clinically significant detection discrepancy, for example, a missed tumor. And choice 5, a finding of a clinically significant interpretation discrepancy, for example, interpreting a tumor as a stroke. Nearly 88% of the studies agreed with their original reports, and there was a 2% rate of clinically significant discrepancies that encompassed 8 CTs and 12 MRs among neuroradiologists. The authors are quite open with discussing their potential sources of bias in the study. Of additional interest, the authors felt their results may have limited generalizability because they only reviewed cases for which follow-up studies were being done, thus potentially introducing disease selection bias. Also, the study design may have introduced some hindsight bias by allowing the reviewers to see how the case evolved over time. The most obvious potential flaw of this entire study, authors discuss this in detail, is the lack of an absolute truth. For example, if both readers misinterpreted the study, it's not scored as a miss, but it's still interpreted incorrectly. Most discrepancies involve the interpretations of vascular and neoplastic lesions. This is a very interesting paper and certainly worthy of reading. This threshold could potentially serve to benchmark future PQI studies. And good luck, Johns Hopkins, as they move forward with that. The next paper, some similar names, Babiars et al., Usum and Drs. Parker, Levin, and Rao, is entitled Utilization Rates of Neuroradiology Across Neuroscience Specialties in the Private Office Setting. Who owns or leases the scanners on which studies are performed? This utilization paper was initially published online October 27, 2011. I think that discussing RVU data is a bit like discussing religion or politics. The topic is potentially incendiary. We all count them for ourselves and we all pretend that they are not worthwhile, but we're all very concerned. One thing for certain, all of us are interested in interpreting studies that have high RVU value. We know they generate income. This trend extends to imaging studies ordered by and interpreted by non-radiologists. In this paper, the authors used 10 years of data from CMS to assess this issue in regards to CT and MR studies, studies which tend to generate good RVUs. During this period of time, MR and CT studies grew 2.5 and 2.1% respectively. In 2008, only 56.6% of fees were charged by radiologists. This figure was followed by independent testing facilities, other specialists, neurologists, and finally neurosurgeons. The authors concluded that all non-radiologists showed greater overall utilization growth in private office neuroradiology than did radiology. Also, non-radiologists generally showed greater utilization increases in MR than CT. Radiologists' private office neuroradiology technical fee share shrank from 83.6% to 56.6% between 1998 and 2008. This is a very fascinating paper and a complex topic and certainly worthy of some additional review. Personally, this is a topic that I've been interested in from the time that Dr. Bruce Hillman became my second chair at UVA. Further research is needed to clarify whether non-radiologists are simply meeting the demand of markets that are not well served by radiologists, or whether non-radiologists are artificially raising the need for private office neuroradiology by altering their own practice profiles. And I would say, place your bets. The next paper by Puig, Pedraza et al. Is entitled Quantification of Thrombus Hounsfield Units on Non-Contrast CT Predicts Stroke Subtype and Early Recanalization After Intravenous Recombinant Tissue Plasminogen Activator. This paper was initially published online December 15, 2011. The hyperdense MCA sign is a sign of acute infarction we all learned during our fellowships or during residency. The indication of the presence of in situ thrombosis of an intracranial vessel is a conspicuous and often primary sign of the presence of acute cerebral vascular disease and developing infarction. The neuroradiology, neurology, and interventional neuroradiology community have another significance attached to this high-density thrombus. Anecdotally, people know that high-density clots are probably more organized and may prove more difficult to lyse. These investigators calculated Hounsfield unit values for middle cerebral artery thrombi on non-contrast CT within 4.5 hours of symptom onset and correlated it with successful recanalization after intravenous TPA treatment that was given 169 plus or minus 102 minutes thereafter. The potential difficulty in this evaluation, the effect of hematocrit on the density, was corrected by the authors by comparing the high-density MCA with the contralateral MCA and calculating a ratio, referred to in this paper as RHU, value. Of 87 consecutive patients, 45 received intravenous RTPA, and only 15, or 33% of the patients, had acute recanalization. RHU values and stroke mechanism were the highest predictive factors of recanalization. The correlation coefficient was best for the RHU at 0.901. Best outcomes in this series were achieved for M1 thrombi, for thrombi that were of relative low density, and those that did not originate from the heart. Worst outcomes were related to intrinsically high-density thrombi and those originating from the heart. So in this paper, we have another important consideration in the value of the acute stroke CT exam. Now let's move to the editor's choices for the month of January. The first paper by Brinjicji et al., including our friends Drs. Kalmus, Lanzino, and Kloft, Hospitalization Costs for Endovascular and Surgical Treatment of Unruptured Cerebral Aneurysms in the United States are substantially higher than Medicare payments. This paper first published online October 27, 2011. Adding to the complexity and decision processes in the treatment of cerebral aneurysms, aneurysm clipping is associated, obviously, and has been well shown, with longer hospital stays and higher total charges. Our recent past has shown that coiling of the aneurysms has become essentially routine, and our specialty really needs to know how much we're getting paid for these two procedures. For uncomplicated treatments, the average Medicare payment for clipping and for coiling was 49% and 53% respectively. For patients with unfortunate but occasional major complications, the average percentage payments decreased to 34% and 41% for coiling and clipping respectively. Therefore, hospitalization costs for patients undergoing clipping and coiling of unruptured cerebral aneurysms are substantially higher than the subsequent Medicare payments. The next paper of editor's choices by Dolick et al., entitled Intra and Extraluminal Structural and Functional Venous Anomalies in Multiple Sclerosis, as evidenced by two non-invasive imaging techniques. This paper was originally published online December 22, 2011. For those of us keeping up with this topic, the verdict still appears to be out on the association of venous disease and MS. It is, however, a hot topic of the highest order. Emotional discussions have occurred regarding this line of investigation, and certainly the absolute truth is still to be rendered. Here is yet another article that should add to the controversy of this relationship between multiple sclerosis and venous anomalies. The authors assessed the utility of Doppler sonography and MR venography using two different techniques for detecting intra and extraluminal venous abnormalities in 150 MS patients and 63 healthy matched controls. The results were as follows. MS patients had significantly more intraluminal and structural abnormalities than controls, and patients with progressive MS had more extraluminal and flow abnormalities than those with non-progressive disease. Doppler sonography is more sensitive than MRV in detecting intraluminal structure and functional venous abnormalities in patients with MS compared to healthy controls, but MRV is more sensitive in depicting collateral pathways. The final paper for the month of January by Drs. Bruce Raymer and Dillon is entitled Idiopathic Thoracic Spinal Cord Herniation, Retrospective Analysis Supporting a Mechanism of Discogenic Dural Injury and Subsequent Tamponade. This paper was originally published online December 15, 2011. Idiopathic thoracic spinal cord herniation is a rare but treatable condition of uncertain etiology, and if you are among those following the AJNR blog, there has been considerable discussion of this entity among readers. In this paper, the authors postulate that anterior thoracic disc herniations erode the dura, and as we all know, they are not uncommonly calcified or associated with avulsed or attached osteophytes. Subsequently, the cord becomes anteriorly displaced to tamponade the defect, resulting in cord compression, deformity, edema, and a progressive myelopathy. To attempt to prove their point, the authors retrospectively reviewed their own cases and all published cases of thoracic spinal cord herniation. In more than two-thirds of cases, the herniations occurred at disc levels, not at the mid-vertebral body level, which supported their hypothesis. Consistent with the proposed pathogenesis, the authors also found evidence of an HNP at the level of the thoracic vertebrae in 30% of the cases they reviewed. Compare this with the known fact of asymptomatic thoracic disc herniations with an incidence of only around 11 to 13%. The presence of the, if you will, smoking gun of a calcified osteophyte was noted in many of these cases. While we may never know with 100% certainty, this certainly is a very significant association and the likely etiology of thoracic spinal cord herniation. That's all for the January podcast from the American Journal of Neuroradiology. My name is Doug Phillips from New York City. Happy to be with you again this month. We'll talk to you again next month.